The Church of God, the Eternal, presents the 17th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, November 22nd, 2025.
Well, today we're going to continue on this book of the survey, the books of Samuel. If you recall from last time, we made it almost halfway through chapter 17 of 1 Samuel, right in the middle of the story of David and Goliath. It's 58 verses, so there wasn't any way I was going to try and rush to get all that done in one message. Hopefully we'll get chapter 17 finished today, no guarantees, but that's the goal. So if you remember for the first half of chapter 17, we read and described the run-up to David's showdown with Goliath. In quick summary, the Philistines and a massive army then invaded in across the borders of Judah, arrayed themselves on one hillside across a valley. Saul then brought his armies together on the hillside looking across at that same valley. And they basically had a standoff now for over 40 days. During this time now, the champion of the Philistines, Goliath from the city of Gath, who we went through the description that he was likely 9 foot 9 inches, if the scholars are right about their estimates for a cubit and all of those other measurements. But as we mentioned, unlike, you know, some of these modern day giants that are very, very tall, but very, very thin and not necessarily strong, this giant had to have been proportionate for his height, with the kind of the weight of the chain mail that he wore, the spear, the javelin, everything else that he had. And therefore, this was quite a striking champion for the Philistines. So he comes out twice a day, morning and evening, taunting the Israelite army, asking them to bring someone out to see which people would be blessed. And of course, then he's incredibly blasphemous toward the God of Israel, which is the thing that ultimately is going to get him in the most trouble. So we saw that David, now coming at the instruction of his father with food for his three oldest brothers who were part of Saul's army now, and now comes into the midst of the camp just in time to have Goliath come on the scene with his taunt. Whether it's one of his morning encounters or one of the evening, it doesn't tell us. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on trying to debate what that might be. If it's in the morning, did everything that transpires now that we're going to read picking up in verse 26 happen from the morning until an evening? My biggest concern with that is if David goes out against Goliath in the evening just before sunset, and what we're going to find, you all know the story already, and then the Israelites are basically going to chase the Philistines all the way back to their own cities, that would have put it in nighttime. And did that happen, or was this a deal where David first hears the taunting of Goliath in the evening, and then there's an overnight that takes place before David confronts Goliath in the morning, so that the Israelite army has all day, in essence? So we don't know. It could have happened either way. Bible and God didn't choose to tell us. Picking up the story now in verse 26, he hears the taunting of Goliath, and he's asking the army. Now, they've been listening to this twice a day for 40 days. This is brand new to David. He's aghast at what he's hearing from this pagan Philistine, especially showing disrespect to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Verse 26, and David spake to the men. This is a repeat. We covered this at the very end of the last message. David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? This is his focus, as we mentioned before, is not on the mammon that King Saul had promised to the Israelite soldier who was willing to defeat Goliath, but more so from the standpoint of God and defending the honor of God. And David is asking more so, what is a servant of God going to receive who is willing to take up this challenge, who takes away the reproach of Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him after this manner, saying, so shall it be done to the man that kills him. They're just focused on the physical things they've already talked about before. All right, now, verse 28, we read the story. I'm going to call it the story of an older brother's jealousy. Verse 28 says, and Eliab, the eldest brother, meaning of David, heard when he, David, his little brother, spake unto the men. Here's this young boy, and is he 17, 18? Don't know for certain, but that's kind of how I see it. He comes into this army of veteran soldiers, and here's this youth, this pipsqueak, who's now saying, what are y'all doing standing around here? Have you ever heard what this, you know, this Philistine, this uncircumcised Philistine is saying? What are we going to do about it? Well, the oldest brother of David is incensed. Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, why camest thou down hither? So out of Eliab's mouth comes an accusation against his youngest brother. And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? So he starts by making an accusation that in essence David slinked away from his duties back home taking care of the sheep, as if his father, their father, doesn't know anything about this, and David's just, you know, out on a joyride. Eliab says, I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle. You're just a rubbernecker wanting to come down here and be a part of it when you have no business here, stirring up trouble. So Eliab, in essence, is claiming to know what's in David's heart. He's passing judgment on the intents of David, claiming to know his motivation down deep inside. And this is a warning against that very trap that you and I can easily fall into when we come into some sort of a conflict with somebody else, when our emotions rise up, and then we want by nature to lash out and to find fault. And maybe you and I know something that truly is faulty in someone else's motive. Maybe we're right. But I guarantee you, if we make a habit out of passing judgment on the intents of someone else, just because we would like them to get what's theirs, we would like them to pay a price because they've annoyed us in some way, or maybe we have legitimate evidence that they've done something that deserves some comeuppance. But I guarantee you, if we give in to that, the day is coming sooner or later when we will make a mistake in judging a motive. It's like rolling the dice. And how serious does God consider it when we condemn someone incorrectly? Isn't that the same spirit that got Jesus Christ killed? So what Eliab is giving into is the natural dictates, and he's just upset because here's his youngest brother of all, and he's the oldest. I don't know, how old was Eliab compared to David? Eliab is the first, David is the eighth. There were daughters in between. I mean, they might have been 15 to 20 years apart. Literally, Eliab might have been potentially the age of a father. And yet here's this whippersnapper coming in here saying, what have you guys been doing? You know, you're being affronted by this enemy. Like, what are we going to do about it? Verse 29, and David said, responds to his brother's accusation and taunt. David said, what have I now done? Is there not a cause? Verse 30, I'm going to read it and we'll analyze it. And he turned from him, Eliab, toward another and spake after the same manner. Meaning David wasn't deterred at all. He repeated the very same thing he proposed to these soldiers. And the people answered him again after the former manner. What are we going to do about this? And what reward is going to be received of the servant of God who puts this Philistine in his place, is in essence what David is talking about. So David's just arrived to the army. He asks a valid question. And he's now being attacked by his brother. It's a way of, you know, David's reply is like saying, seriously, what crime have I committed here? But he doesn't dwell on it. He doesn't wear his heart on his sleeve. He doesn't spend all his time talking about the way his older brother's taken advantage of him his entire life and blah, 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 blah. He just says, what have I done? And then he like dismisses his brother and turns his attention back to the soldiers, which I think is a pretty powerful, you know, flex, if you will. David pivots the conversation from this attack on him personally. He basically brushes it off and turns back to the threat of Goliath, reminding everyone, including Eliab, why they're all there. And the effect of this is to elevate the discourse from away from petty family squabbles to the intent, the big picture of what is really a divine warfare. This is really the enemies of the God of Israel now taunting that God, dismissing that God, showing disrespect toward the God of Israel, claiming they're more powerful and more righteous by comparison. And this has been going on for 40 days. By asking, David is inviting agreement, forcing all the onlookers, including Eliab, to confront their own inaction for the last 40 days. And that's probably much of this is at the heart of it. David comes on the scene. He's new to this thing. What are we standing around here? Why has this been going on? Why hasn't anybody done something? Have you ever been one of those or been in a group where somebody else comes in and says, why hasn't anybody done anything? And that is annoying, isn't it? I mean, if you're one of the ones that's not been able to solve a problem or you're not sure what to do, and someone else comes in fresh and says, why haven't you done anything? Yeah, we should all identify with that. The difference is God is involved in this and inspiring and helping this young whippersnapper in this particular case. So Eliab symbolically represents the fearful, faithless status quo who basically just keeps kicking the can down the road with the way things are, waiting for something else to change. Quick to criticize and slow to act. And he didn't like being called out by it. David, by contrast, embodies youthful audacity, rooted in a faith or a confidence, which may or may not be misplaced. Because young people are apt to do rash things and make mistakes, when it would be better and maturity and experience would dictate a different response. So if not for the unique help that God is giving to this young man, he might truly have just been, you know, naive and foolish. That could have been possible. But the exchange that takes place between David and these soldiers foreshadows the rise of David, which we're now getting ready to see. Eliab's rebuke of his brother only propels David forward to the king. So in other words, Eliab trying to call down his brother brings more attention to the drama. So David had a greater audience, probably, in the midst of this exchange that took place. David is getting ready to emerge from the shackles of his family position as the youngest child. This is the breakout, if you will, think about it, where he stops just being the youngest member of the family within that structure. David, from now on, is breaking out of that and will never return to that status. Verse 31, when the words were heard which David spake, and that was a lot of people listening, they rehearsed them before Saul. Somebody, some group of them actually went to Saul. They thought what this young man was saying in the midst of the army was important enough that they made a report to King. They rehearsed them before Saul, and he, Saul, sent for him, David. Saul sent for David. Pretty amazing thing. Now, I wonder what all the dynamics were. Literally, just some young shepherd boy comes in to deliver food to his brothers in the army, asks some questions and makes some bold statements, and he's going to get an escort for an audience with the king. And not everything adds up. I'm going to postulate that this is one of the evidences, potentially, that Saul knew David. And again, we went through that in chapter 16, the fact that David was called to the court of Saul to play the harp in order to soothe him from his mental difficulties when that evil spirit would come upon him. Okay, so presuming then that this had already happened, and we saw, and I'll read it again in a little bit, but you recall it, Saul came to love David, made him his armor bearer. Okay, so, and I don't believe at all that Saul was mentally ill or deranged or, you know, suffering from dementia. But here, now he shows up in an unexpected place, and now he's brought to Saul. I suspect Saul was very well aware who David was, but now he's seeing him in a very different context, because he's not the meek, mild little shepherd boy who was called to court to play the harp. All of a sudden now he's making these bold statements concerning this Philistine threat. The army of Saul was so demoralized at this point that apparently having anyone, even a mere youth, stand up and speak boldly sent shockwaves through the ranks. It was very different from what had been going on for over a month. Verse 32, and David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him, Goliath." David hasn't backed off one little bit. He's just as bold in front of the king as he was in the group of the soldiers. "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant," meaning me, "I'll go and fight with this Philistine." He says, "I'm volunteering. I'm not just all words. I volunteer to go face him." Pretty amazing. This is either a foolish, arrogant boast by an inexperienced youth, or else it's a manifestation of God's special inspiration to one he's going to use as a powerful servant. And we already know which case it is. Verse 33, and Saul said to David in reply, "Thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth." You're just a young boy. And he, Goliath, a man of war from his youth. He's been training as a soldier from his youth. David said unto Saul, "Thy servant kept his father's sheep." Now, David's going to have to rehearse some elements from his short resume to try and convince Saul that he can actually deal with a dangerous situation and an enemy. "Thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear." Now, he's saying, I've faced deadly threats two different times. "There came a lion and a bear and took," implying each one of them, "took a lamb out of the flock." He says, verse 35, "and I went out after him." He didn't shrink back, just accept the loss, hope the lion or the bear would go away after it got its, you know, belly full. "I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth." The word smote, it means struck him. So this word doesn't mean he killed him, as you'll see. It means he went up and smote him, probably with his staff. I don't think it would have been with a fist. And he is carrying a staff, as you're going to see in the storyline momentarily. He says, "I smote him, I struck him, and delivered it out of his mouth." He struck the lion first so hard he made him drop the sheep that was in his mouth. And a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock. "I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth, and when he arose against me." So he's still alive. All he did was make him drop the lamb. "When he arose against me, I caught him by his beard." Now he's up and personal. He's not at a rod or a staff's length away. He's up close and personal. I caught him by his beard and smote him, struck him again, and slew him. Now he killed him. And it doesn't say exactly what by what means. Is it literally by the power of using a staff to crush his skull? It doesn't give us the details. But he fought with him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear. He said, I did this not once, but twice. It wasn't a fluke. And this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them. Pretty tough talk. Pretty tough talk. This uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, either that lion or that bear, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. David is still putting it in context, not as Goliath has showed disrespect to King Saul or to the armies of Israel. He's calling them the armies of the living God. God is the center of attention here in the mind of David. And that's very, very different than all the soldiers that we were talking about previously. Verse 37, David said moreover, David wasn't finished. He's got the ear of Saul and he's going to keep talking. David said, moreover, the Eternal that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. That's how confident, that's how assured he was. Was it false confidence? Well, we know the end. But how would you know? So let's say you were there at the moment and you didn't know the outcome of this or that God was going to intervene by a divine miracle. What would you think? You'd be inclined, like I would, to think, this kid has no idea. He has no idea what he's talking about. But this is exactly the kind of courage that is needed by anyone who is going to fulfill a calling of God. That's how it applies to you and me. Not human arrogance, not self-will, not promotion or defense of self, but the faith and the confidence and the courage that is needed to stand by a way that has been revealed, to refuse to compromise it, and no matter how mighty or powerful the threat is that stands before us, and no matter what they threaten, to say, I will not compromise. So we're not being asked to go out and fight a giant. Physically, we're not being asked to volunteer, you know, to face a champion. But we are required to stand firm and defend the truth in our own lives, aren't we? You are required to defend the borders of yourself as a servant of God. You are required not to allow anyone to browbeat you or to scare you into compromising the truth in order to save yourself. But it takes exactly the same kind of frame of mind that David was manifesting here, doesn't it? Which is an absolute conviction in the existence of the living God. Do you see in any way here that David doubted the existence or the power or the involvement of God in the nation of Israel? No, that's a given fact, isn't it? And I think that's easy to read over. Well, of course, I'm reading the story of David and Goliath. I guess I'm trying to get us all to back up a little bit and not presume and read into it. You've been hearing this story since your childhood, so have I. But look at the mechanics that are involved and what it would take in a frame of mind of a human being to be able to do this. It's not highlighting David as a freak exception to the rule. My proposal to you is that this is exactly the kind of thinking that God wants from us and what we must aspire to. Not for self-aggrandizement, simply to defend the truth that you have been given and let no one take it away from you. And if you do that, especially in the days that we live now, in the days that we believe are ahead of us before the end of this age and the return of Jesus Christ, it's going to take courage. It's going to take individuals who are willing not to be cowed by an enemy. Who are willing to stand up, not because you're trying to bring attention to yourself. I love the idea of, you know, staying in the shadows and staying out of trouble. But the truth is, the day is going to come that God is going to allow his people to be in the spotlight not by their choice, but by circumstances, especially because we face the God of this world, who is going to bring the children of God to the attention for the sake of persecution and tribulation. Will we have the courage and the faith and the confidence in order to stand firm and not be cowed? Like Job expressed, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. That's the same sentiment that you see in the mind of David here. Though he slay me, I'm not going to be afraid, because I believe in this God, and this God deserves to be defended. I'm going to put myself in his hands. He's going to fight the battle, but I'm not going to be cowed. I'm not going to run away. Verse 33, and Saul said to David, thou art not able to go. Well, we read that part, sorry. So I mentioned the courage needed for anyone to fulfill this charge. Let's turn to John 10 very quickly. Because here in this story that David gave about defending the sheep also against the lion, against the bear, made me think now about Christ's words here in John 10 concerning the job of a faithful shepherd. John 10, verse 11, Jesus Christ says, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd giveth his life for the sheep. Wasn't it true that David was setting his own life at risk by battling that lion and then that bear in order to save a lamb who was in the jaws? And it would have been easier for him to say, oh, sorry, can't do anything for you. Jesus says, I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. He is willing to put his own life at risk for the good and for the help and the defense of the children of God. Verse 12, by comparison, but he that is a hireling, just a paid servant, you know, they're just getting a wage to take care of the sheep. They don't really care about the sheep. They're just getting paid to do the job, so they're going through the motions. He that's a hireling and not the shepherd, whose own the sheep are not, what does he do and how does he think when the threat comes? Sees the wolf coming, or the lion or the bear, and leaves the sheep and flees. And the wolf catches them and scatters the sheep. The hireling flees because he's a hireling. He has no skin in the game. When danger comes, he's out of there. He's saying, huh, my own life is not worth what I'm getting paid. So he runs away. He's a hireling and cares not for the sheep. Verse 14, Christ is trying to show us how differently he views his beloved children in the name of the Father. Verse 14, I am the good shepherd and know my sheep and am known of mine. And the Father, as the Father knows me, this is the standard by which Christ is judging what it is, the relationship that we're talking about. As the Father knows me, even so know I the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. That's the mentality we're talking about. God is jealous for his beloved children. He didn't call you to fail. He didn't open your mind to the truth and then kind of just send you out on your own to be victimized, especially because he called primarily the weak and the base, the most defenseless people by nature, and probably IQ, ability, experience, are sent out into a world full of wolves. And that's a recipe for disaster without miraculous intervention. And God is saying, no, he loves those sheep, and he will give up his life for them, which is exactly what Jesus Christ did. So there's the mentality of a good shepherd. In essence, I would tell you that what young David showed, even as a teenager, and his willingness to put his own life at risk, shows you a different mentality of courage that is quite unusual. So that's David's resume, little as it is, to try and convince Saul to let him take up the challenge. Back to 1 Samuel 17, now verse 37, the rest of verse 37. And Saul said unto David, go He says, okay, you've convinced me. Go, and the Eternal be with you. I wonder if he said that with conviction or just kind of, you know, people say that, you know, God be with you, flippantly, which, by the way, can very easily be another one of those ways we take God's name in vain. It's one thing to say it with sincerity and with purpose. It's another thing just to, you know, God be with you. So Saul gives him the permission. Okay, now what? How's this going to work? Saul armed David with his armor. Now remember from chapter 16, David had been appointed as Saul's armor bearer. So David was familiar with all of the armor of Saul. Not from the standpoint of ever having put it on, but taking care of it. And providing it and having it ready for Saul when he needed it. And here's the irony of ironies. And now the king is literally having his own armor put on the youth. Saul armed David with his armor, and he put a helmet of brass upon his head. Also, he armed him with a coat of mail. I wonder how heavy Saul's coat of mail was. I don't think it was 125 pounds like Goliath's, but it was heavy. And remember, Saul was tall among Israelites. Remember back when he was first picked and he was a likely choice for king because of the way he looked? He was taller. He's like a head taller than everybody else. Wonder how tall that was. Was he like 6'5"? 6'6"? What would it have taken? I don't know. But I guarantee you a man that tall was going to have a coat of mail that was actually larger and heavier than most other Israelites of any others who even had any. Probably the majority of them didn't even have a coat of mail. Verse 39, and David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed to go. He puts on this heavy mail, the helmet, picks up the sword, and now he's going to try to walk with it, let alone fight with it. And he essayed to go, for he had not proved. He's going to try and try it out a little bit. And it means he had not tested or tried it out. He had never fought in armor before. Apparently, he'd never fought with a sword, let alone with all, you know, the weight of this armor. And David said unto Saul, I cannot go with these. This isn't going to work. For I have not proved them. I've never fought in armor like this. I'm totally out of my league. He's going to be worse off to go out on a battlefield draped in all that armor. Do you think that armor of itself is going to protect David from being slaughtered by this giant? No. It might just, you know, save him for a short time. But he was going to die. He says, I haven't proven them. I have never used this. And David put them off. He took all that off. He said, this is not going to work. And the spiritual side of this, here's a manifestation, an example of human beings who are going to try to do it their way according to human wisdom. And so they're going to try to protect themselves with their man-made armor and put together all their accoutrements so that they can survive against an attacking enemy. But God was going to do something totally different. God was not going to share his glory with any man. What if David had gone out with all of King Saul's armor and then had prevailed against the Goliath? Do you think there's some percentage of everyone who would have said, well, there's no wonder he won. Look at the armor he had. They would have given credit, not to God, but to the elements of human beings, including the ability to craft protective defensive armor and offensive armor like the sword, and say, well, David was just wise. You know, he was just adroit beyond his years to be able to do this job. God is going to create the circumstance so that there's no doubt this was an absolute divine miracle. All the man-made armor comes off. The victory through David would show that only a powerful God could have made it happen. Turn with me to 2 Corinthians 10. The Apostle Paul expressed the sentiment here. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 3, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh." We don't think like, or we shouldn't be thinking about, oriented like the people of the world. "For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds." He's saying our weapons are not like carnal weapons. They're not like man creates defensive armor and offensive armor in order to win battles and to win wars. In essence, Paul is inspired to write, "Oh, we do have weapons, but they're not the same that human beings are used to." For what purpose? Pulling down of strongholds. What kind of strongholds? Physical forts? Fortifications? No. What are these strongholds? Verse 5, "Casting down imaginations." There's your stronghold. It's the thoughts and the ideas that human beings have that they value so much and revere. The concepts of mind, carnally, are our biggest enemy. Equivalent to an enemy fortified in a fort, which seems to be unable to be breached. Their imaginations, their ideas, and not just other people's, but our own. Most importantly, they are our own imaginations. Those are the strongholds that God wants us to attack and to defeat. There's your enemy. There's your Goliath. You're not being set against a physical, almost 10-foot giant, but you are being asked to confront a giant on a battlefield. But it's our own thoughts, our imaginations, the structures we put together, the things we come to revere, which God ultimately decides are idols, violations of the first and second commandments, things we make more important than fulfilling the will of God. There's our strongholds. Their imaginations, their ideas, they come from the mind, and then they manifest in sin. If we take care of the strongholds, if we defeat the strongholds, then we change our minds, which is what Christianity is all about. "The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God." On the battlefield between Israel and the Philistines, the high thing was manifested in a giant named Goliath. He was the high thing. He was the biggest thing out there to have everybody's attention. And then nobody thought could be defeated. For us, it's casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. There's how you win your victory. There's how you accomplish even more so than young David ever would. And you think what you're doing is not important. I guarantee you it is. With the power of the Holy Spirit, when you are able to defeat a carnal concept, which is actually your enemy, and bring it down and neutralize it and replace it instead with the thinking of God, you just defeated a giant. And it's more significant than anything physical that's ever happened in history. So the armor of God, and that's, we're not going to turn to it. Ephesians 6 describes when Paul says, "Put on the whole armor of God," and each element of the armor, defensive and offensive, is related to a particular spiritual attribute, including truth, righteousness, the gospel of peace, faith, salvation, and the Spirit. And all of them, by the way, except the last, the Spirit, are defensive armor. The armor of God is actually that that protects you from death by the slings and arrows of your enemies. Helmets and breastplates and greaves. The only one that's offensive is actually called the sword of the Spirit. There's the power of God's Holy Spirit, which you wield as your weapon to do something offensively, not to harm anyone else, Because remember, that sword is also, God also describes his truth as a sword which cuts to the marrow and to the bone to reveal what we are. So the sword of the Spirit is really used on ourselves. It helps cut us down so that we can replace the strongholds of our natural minds with the power and the fortifications of the mind of God in Jesus Christ. All right, back to 1 Samuel 17. Now verse 40, the confrontation between David and Goliath. So David takes off the armor. He's not going to go out on the battlefield with that. Verse 40, and he took his staff in his hand. What's he go out there with? His shepherd's staff, the rod, also called a staff, which he uses to guide the sheep. Very likely, it doesn't say for certain, but probably the tool that he used to fight the lion and the bear. It was a shepherd's staff, a rod. He took his staff in his hand and chose him five smooth stones out of the brook and put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had even in a scrip, and it literally means a leather pouch or a small bag that shepherds used as well as travelers, kind of like your carry-on bag in a way. You carry with you to put whatever value or things that you needed. And he's using this to put these five smooth stones. Somebody already asked me in advance, what do the five smooth stones signify? I have no idea. God didn't choose to make a story out of it. Maybe there is. The only thing I see out of it is, does it mean that David wasn't necessarily convinced he was going to, even though he believed God was backing him up, is it possible David didn't presume that he would kill him with one stone? Is it possible he thought he might need more than one shot? I don't know. If he had only gone with one stone, that would have been real confidence, wouldn't it? He went with five. Was that David saying, I don't know how God is going to do this? God inspired him through his spirit with, you know, these declarative statements of what God is going to do. But maybe he admitted he didn't know the details. So he took five stones with him, just in case. And what else did he have besides the staff and these five stones and his sling? His sling in his hand. And he drew near to the Philistine. What do we know about this sling? I kind of looked it up from what the scholars seemed to think about the way it worked, the way it operated. It was like a folded long strand that had this, whether it's leather or whatever, a pocket, basically at the extent of it when it's folded, and that's where the stone was. On one end was like a loop that the slinger actually would put through a finger. In other words, you got an anchor point on one end of it. Then it goes out to its longest end where this pouch holding the stone was, and then back on itself to the hand. The other end would be held in the hand. Wasn't looped, wasn't tied, because you need to be able to let that end go. So the one end had a loop on it that in essence was anchored and would stay connected to the hand. And the other one was held so that when it was slung, centrifugal force, inertia, whichever law you want to use, then the slinger literally could control when and how that stone would be released, because when he released the one end and it flew away, then the stone would fly free from being protected in that pocket from the two ends. So that makes perfect sense, and there's probably some evidence, you know, of an ancient sling. Turn quickly to Judges 20, verse 15. Here is a statement in a whole different context about the use of sling. How accurate could a sling be? Well, apparently, very accurate. It didn't really just require a divine intervention or a miracle by God in order to make a sling a very accurate weapon, if not lethal. And here's the account in Judges 20, verse 15 through 17. And the children of Benjamin were numbered at that time out of the cities 26,000 men that drew sword, beside the inhabitants of Gibeah, which were numbered 700 chosen men. That's kind of the elites associated with Benjamin. And I'm not going through the sordid story in Judges 20. We've covered it before. A why all the rest of the tribes were coming in order to make Benjamin pay because of the heinous sin that these men committed. Verse 16, among all this people, this 26,700 Benjamites, and all this people, among all this people were 700 chosen men left-handed. I think that's interesting. Was that a particular hallmark of Benjamites? Different from the other tribes? Don't know. But in this particular case, 700 of them were left-handed. Everyone could sling stones at a hairbreadth and not miss. How lethal was a sling in that day for ones who were practiced with it? Here it was recorded in the book of Judges that it was absolutely lethal and deadly accurate in the hands of one who knew how to use it. So David, even though he was a youth, obviously had practiced a lot with it, this art that was well known for a long, long time. Okay, back to 1 Samuel 17, verse 41. The Philistine came on and drew near unto David. All right. So David's too far away, apparently, that Goliath hasn't yet been able to size him up. So now Goliath is coming on, walking toward. They're walking. Remember, their armies are at their backs on the hill. They're in this valley. Goliath's already been out there. Now David comes out. So Goliath is going to move forward. Finally, after 40 days, Israel's sending somebody out. He anticipated a veteran soldier who at least appeared to have the ability to be able to fight. Philistine came on and drew near to David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. Remember, he had this shield bearer who went with him. Verse 42, and when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he got close enough to be able to see him up close or in enough detail, he disdained him. Goliath wanted a proper fight. Goliath, in his arrogance and ego, he wanted Israel to bring out their best so that when Goliath beat him, he could crow about it. They sent out this simpering child. And Goliath, in his mind, is like, if I kill him, I'm not going to get any glory out of that. So he was mad about it. He was mad that, in essence, this was going to rob him of the chance to prove what a great champion he was. They're not going to write stories about his chivalry because of beating a youth that's out there with no armor, holding a staff and a sling. When the Philistine looked about, he saw David and he disdained him. For he was but a youth and ruddy and of a fair countenance. Above everything else, as we already talked about, it's this baby-faced kid. He didn't look like a warrior at all. According to man's wisdom, which Goliath represents, the conclusion was that David had no chance at all. He had no chance at all. It was a joke. Verse 43, and the Philistine said to David, am I a dog? Is that what you think I am? Is that how you see me? Is that how Saul and the entire army of Israel sees me? I'm just some mutt, some mangy beast that's an annoyance but no threat? Am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? Aha. What did Goliath key upon that David came out with? Remember, he had his shepherd's rod, which we'd already saw called a staff, and he had his sling, and he has a little pouch with the stones in it. That's all he had. What did Goliath key upon? Apparently the staff. That was the biggest thing David had that looked like the weapon of choice. Am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? Really? You're just going to come in even with a fighting stick. Literally, I'm here with a sword and a javelin and all of my armor, and you're going to come to me with a fighting stick? That's all you think I am? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. That's absolute disdain. So Goliath is calling upon the gods of the Philistines. How did that work out for them way, way back hundreds of years before? Or maybe not hundreds of years before, but many decades before that, when the ark was taken and went around over all those months through the cities. Philistines don't learn their lessons because the next generations will never learn from the older. Same for all of us. The Philistine cursed David by his gods, and the Philistine said to David, "All right, I'm stuck with you. No one else. A proper warrior is not going to come out. All right, come to me. Go ahead. Come on then. I'll give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field." Now, I'm projecting to you that Goliath here is making a short-term prophecy. Goliath is prophesying what is about to happen. And he has absolute conviction it's going to be a reality. He is saying, "I'm going to kill you, and I'm going to leave your dead body out here for the scavengers, and they're going to eat your flesh." That was Goliath's prophecy. Now in verse 45, David replies. This youth facing this 9-foot-9 giant. I don't know what distance. At this point, they're close enough to talk. I don't know how close they are. They're still at a distance apart, as you're going to find out. But now David gets to say his piece. Goliath's speech was pretty short. David kind of went on and on. Verse 45, "Then David said to the Philistine, 'Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield.'" You got a lot of armaments there. "But I come to thee in the name of the Eternal of hosts, of the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied." Do you see the common element here? What is David focusing on? He's not focusing on himself. He's focusing on the disrespect that this heathen has showed toward the God of Israel. And that's what he's talking about. Goliath is talking about David. "You skinny little runt, this is what I'm going to do to you." David's talking about the disrespect Goliath has showed toward his God. He's making God the center of the story. Verse 46, David says, now here's David's prophecy. And if you didn't think David was a prophet, well, he is, and a number of the Psalms of David are actual prophecies. Well, here, maybe this is the first prophecy that God spoke through young David. Verse 46, he says, "This day will the Eternal deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee. And I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth. And all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel." What's David's focus and purpose? Defending God's honor. So that it would become known. What's the aftermath he's looking for? He's not looking for personal reward. His intent, sincerely, is that when all of this is said and done, it will be known there is a God in Israel. It's about justifying the power and the intent and the purposes of this invisible God so that these people, both Israelite and Philistine, come to recognize it as being a fact. That's what was on David's mind. Verse 47, "And all this assembly shall know." He's talking to all the soldiers on both sides. The entire assembly of the ones that are lined up against each other here across this valley. "All this assembly shall know that the Eternal saves not with sword and spear. For the battle is the Eternal's, and he will give you into our hands." He's saying even though physically we're the underdogs, David was certainly underdog compared to this giant. And David's saying, that doesn't even matter. God's going to create a miracle, which is going to set minds on fire. And ironically, it appears that God inspired David basically to turn Goliath's prophecy back on him. Goliath's prophecy was that David's carcass was going to lie there and be eaten. David didn't specifically say that Goliath's carcass would be eaten, but he said, not only you, your whole army. So David's upping the ante. David's not saying this is just you against me. When this day is over, he's saying, all your carcasses are going to be eaten by the scavengers. Proverbs 26, verse 7, very quickly. It reminded me of this. When someone's against the will of God, in essence, sets out to do something, especially by deception, how often does God end up, for his purposes, turn their own plan and their scheme against themselves? Proverbs 26, verse 27 says, whoso digs a pit, meaning the intent of a pit to get somebody else to fall into it, whoso digs a pit shall fall therein, and he that rolleth a stone, it will return upon him. So God does do this. It doesn't always happen. We don't get justice in this world, but sooner or later, God does turn the evil intents of the abusers and the persecutors and the tempters back on themselves. They become the victim of their own scheme that they wanted in order to derail someone else. And so it reminded me of this very much. In essence, Goliath is prophesying what he's going to do to David. And David, by God's inspiration, says, well, not only you, but your whole army. You're the ones that are going to be carrion for the vultures. Verse 48, back in 1 Samuel 17. And it came to pass when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh. Now, all right, talking's over. Goliath's walking forward. Came and drew nigh to meet David. But David hasted and ran toward the army. He didn't back up. He didn't stop. He didn't stand still. He didn't take two or three steps backward, which would have been my natural response. The giant starts coming for him now. David hasted and ran toward the army, meaning toward the enemy army line, at Goliath, away from the safety of his own army behind him. He's running forward right into the midst of the danger. Hasted and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine, and David put his hand in his bag while he's running and took thence a stone and slung it. He put it in this pocket, ready in the sling, and smote the Philistine in the forehead. Just like that. Now, it doesn't mean it was a killing stroke yet. He smote. Keep it in mind, we have potential ponderable to figure out here. Smote the Philistine in the forehead, and the stone sunk into his forehead, and he, the giant, fell upon his face to the earth. He's walking forward. He literally gets hit in the forehead right under the crest of his protective helmet. And that stone hit him right in the vulnerable spot and sunk into his skull. And his movements walking forward toward David, he just kept going and fell on his face. And David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and smote the Philistine and slew him. See, there's two different things going on. They're striking him, which is smiting, or here the fact that he was smitten or smote him and slew him. So you've got the strike that disables, and then you've got a follow-up that kills and slew him. So was this one thing that this, you know, that's the question. Did this stone literally sinking into his forehead and he falls on his face, is he dead? Is he immediately dead? Maybe, maybe not. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Can you think of a greater spectacle? You've got, compared to an arena full of spectators of a sporting event, you've got two full armies of thousands and thousands on each side. In essence, of this valley arena watching this take place. And now David is going to follow through and do exactly what he said he was going to do to fulfill the prophecy he made. Verse 51, therefore David ran. So I don't know, what distance did David sling that stone and hit the giant? Far enough distance, unlike portrayals like this recent one that came out, you know, in a series, and it showed Goliath having time to throw his spear and wounded David in the side, and he went down, and then he put his hand with blood on his side and then grabbed the bloody stone. And no, that's all nonsense. Goliath didn't have time to do anything with a sword or a spear. He just started walking toward David and got hit in the head with a stone. Therefore, verse 51, David ran and stood upon the Philistine. He had to close the distance and took his sword, Goliath's sword. David didn't have a sword, and drew it out of the sheath thereof and slew him. So wait a minute. Did the stone kill him? Because now it's saying David killed the giant with the sword and slew him and cut off his head therewith. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. So the best way I know to try and reconcile it, the stone that hit Goliath in the forehead was like a killing stroke. It doesn't mean that he was dead, that his heart had stopped beating yet. But I guarantee you he would have died. If you'd left him alone long enough, he was not going to get up. But the best way to reconcile, how does it say David slew him by smiting the Philistine with a stone, and yet then he slew him with a sword? The killing stroke, the first killing stroke, the disabling stroke, which put him out, was the stone. He wasn't going to get up again, but he may have still been alive, though absolutely disabled and brain damaged. And now David is going to finish him off. So the cutting by the sword, cutting his head off, that sealed the deal. So in short order, God turned an absolutely demoralized Israelite army into a victor. The Philistines had the upper hand. They were the ones who were enthused. They had morale on their side. They knew they were going to win. 40 days this has been going on. And all of a sudden, by the stroke of a stone in a sling, everything changes 180 degrees. Verse 52, and the men of Israel and of Judah, the ones who thought there was no way they could win, and all of a sudden, Goliath is dead. The men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines until thou come to the valley and to the gates of Ekron. That means they went all the way, chased them all the way over the hill that the Philistines were encamped upon, on the other side, and now all the way out of the territory of Judah, all the way to the valley territory, which was the majority of that which the Philistines held. The lowlands between the mountains of Judah and the sea. And remember, we already went through where those main cities of Ekron and Gath were, which were like almost like border towns, if you will, on the edge. Until thou come to the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistine fell down, by the way, to Sheraim, even unto Gath, which was the home city of Goliath, ironically, and unto Ekron. And the children of Israel, so they chased them that far, killed as many of them as they could, and the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistines, and they spoiled their tents. So this was the case, wasn't like when God sent Saul to wipe out the Amalekites. God gave no direction. One, they did not expect a victory. But God had not told Saul in advance or anyone else that he was going to give them victory over the Philistines and that they weren't to take any spoils. This was a case where God was okay with them taking spoils. So in essence, the army fled and left them. all of their tents and their baggage and their weapons and everything right there. They killed as many of them as they could, chased them out, and then came back and then looted all of the spoils. David takes his own trophies. Verse 54, David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. So David kept the head of the giant and all of the giant's armor. All those things that had already been described, that 125-pound mail coat and the shield. He had to have some help. I know he wasn't carrying that. But he kept, that was his loot. He kept all the armor, the sword, the javelin, apparently, and put that in his tent. That was his. And he still got the giant's head, probably holding it by the hair in his hand. The question is, why Jerusalem? We haven't had Jerusalem anywhere in this whole storyline. Jerusalem wasn't even in the control of the Israelites. Toward the end of this last text, Joshua 15, verse 36. Because all the way back in the days of Joshua, and Israel first came into the promised land, and God was going to give them the entire land. There shouldn't have ever had to be a war against the Philistines. There should not have had to been a war against the Amalekites or anyone else. The only reason Israel had to continually fight was because they had never fulfilled what God told them to do. So they received the promised land, but not without a lot of problems and difficulties, which lasted for hundreds of years, including what they were dealing with now. But back in Joshua 15:63, as for the Jebusites, who are these? The Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem. The children of Judah could not drive them out. The city of Jerusalem was in the territory that God gave to Judah. It should have been under control of Judah. And yet, the Jews never took possession up to this time of the city of Jerusalem. It was a fortified city for sure. And because of the sins of the people, God didn't create a miracle like he did with Jericho. Drop the walls and give them miraculous ability to take over the city. The children of Judah could not drive them out, but the Jebusites dwell with the children of Judah at Jerusalem unto this day. Now that was in the days when the book of Joshua was written. But that carried forward all the way down to the very time that we're talking about, in the days of David. How do we know that? Because the city of Jerusalem would not become Israelite and become the capital city under David, King David, until David and his army take it. And that's not going to happen yet for a number of years in this storyline. So Jerusalem is still a fortified city of Jebusites. Now, apparently, they had a live and let live arrangement with the Israelites who lived all around them. But somehow the Jebusites were able to survive holding on to the fort of Jerusalem. So why do we read here, David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem? As we're going to find when we get into the very first, I think it's verse 2 of chapter 18, when David is taken to Saul, David's not going to go home again. David's not going to return home to Bethlehem. He's going to go with Saul and then thereafter be a part of the court and the entourage of Saul in his hometown. And likely Jerusalem was just kind of on the way if you're going to go north up to Gibeah. So Jerusalem, or the outskirts of Jerusalem, not in the city of Jerusalem, that was off limits to the Israelites, but they went to Jerusalem, maybe camped outside it on their way to the final destination, as we're going to find out, but not till we get to chapter 18. So that takes us not to the total end of chapter 17, but close enough. And the remaining part now, we're going to see next time, beginning in verse 55, the first time David, with this head of the giant in his hand, talks with Saul, and the aftermath which happens, which changes the entire life of David and of Saul as well. We'll get to that next time.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the 17th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, November 22nd, 2025.